Have you ever thought about finding, like, a 240-year-old document? Not just any old deed, but a complete plan for a whole town.
Right.
We're talking houses, farms, even down to the firewood someone could gather. It's pretty wild.
It really is.
And that's what we're diving into today. This document called the Zamosscher und Siedlungsverträge. It's from February 28th, 1785.
A really foundational text for German settlement in that part of Poland back then.
Exactly. And we're using actual detailed bits from the contract itself for this deep dive.
Yeah, straight from the source.
Our mission really is to unpack how this single agreement shaped, well, everything for these German settlers. It's this mix of amazing opportunity and incredibly strict rules.
A real planned community centuries ago.
Yeah, you'll see how it offered a chance, but also defined pretty much their whole existence. Okay, let's get into it. This blueprint for life. Houses, firewood, the works.
So Poland, 1785, the Zamojskie Ordination Dominion, that's the local feudal power, basically they had what the contract calls a highest intention.
Okay, and what was that?
Well, the core idea was this Freiwilligen Vertrag, a voluntary contract. But voluntary. Maybe not quite how we'd think of it today.
Right. How so?
It needed state approval from the Landesgebenichi, the state governorship. But once that happened, it was meant to, and I quote, "auf ewige Zeiten für dauern und rechtsbeständig verbleiben sollen." Basically, endure for eternal times and remain legally binding forever.
Wow, eternal times. That's
Yeah.
ambitious, doesn't even cover it for a contract.
Yeah.
How do they plan to make that stick?
It shows just how long-term they were thinking. It
Yeah.
was cemented with this concept of Enfidiaticum oder Erbrecht auf ewige Zeiten.
Okay, break that down for us.
It's essentially an emphitutic right. Think of it like a perpetual lease or hereditary right to the property, again, for all eternity.
So it passes down through generations, locked in.
Exactly. And to manage all this, they were creating a detailed Grundbuch, a land register.
Like a doomsday book for this specific settlement.
Kind of, yeah. It wasn't just a record. They called it an untrügerisches Gesetzbuch, an unfailing law book for the settlements, designed to be of ewige Zeiten unverändert, unchanged, forever.
That level of planning is just mind-boggling. So the main players here were the Dominium, the Lords of the Royal Imperial District Office, and these 100 German families signing up.
That's right.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Who exactly were these 100 families, and what did they actually get up front for signing on to this forever deal?
So the contract is very specific. It was 100 families total. 90 were Acherloot farmers,
Okay.
and 10 were professionisten, tradesmen or craftsmen. Their exact trades were to be decided later when they were actually selected.
And the land, how much did they get?
Each farmer family got 30 kreutz. A kreutz was, well, a decent chunk of land back then,
Right.
and it was broken down precisely. One kreutz for the house and garden, 5 kreutz for meadows, and the other 24 for fields to plow.
Super specific. And the tradesmen?
They also got the 1 kreutz for house and garden, but for farmland, it just said, as much as they themselves demand. The assumption being, they wouldn't be full-time farmers.
Makes sense. Did the contract dictate their houses too? I mean, were they just given plots or actual homes?
Oh, actual homes built to spec. The details are amazing. Wooden walls, straw roof, a proper boarded room inside, another big chamber, a kitchen.
A kitchen with.
With a built-in masonry oven and a masonry chimney, plus a stable for 8 paddle and a barn.
Okay, so they arrived to ready-made farmsteads, basically. Who paid for all that?
The Dominium. It says they built it aus eigenem Materiale und Kosten, from their own materials and costs, but
Uh-oh, there's a but.
there's a but. Each settler family was obligated to pitch in to work on it to the best of their ability without special payment or further reward.
Ah. So free labor to build their own homes, essentially.
Pretty much. And if your house burned down because you were careless, you had to rebuild it yourself. So the Dominium did promise free building materials in that case.
Okay, so land and a house frame, plus some unpaid construction work. But farming needs more than that. How do they get started with, animals and tools if they were just arriving?
Good question. It wasn't just, here's your land, good luck. There was an initial endowment.
Like a startup package.
Exactly like a startup package.
Yep.
Each farmer got a Mutterschwein, a sow,
Oh.
plus livestock described as Besserumschlag, better quality.
What did that include?
2 horses, one had to be a mare, 2 draft oxen, and 2 cows.
Yeah, the tradesman.
They got livestock too, but sort of scaled down proportional to their land.
Tools.
Yep, a specific list. an iron-fitted wagon mit Eisenbeschlagenen Wagen, a
Yeah.
plow, a harrow with iron teeth, and an iron-fitted shovel. Everything you'd need to get going.
Okay, that sounds pretty generous. Animals, tools, land, house. Was this just given to them?
Well, no, not quite a gift.
I sense that coming.
Yeah. The value of all that livestock and equipment, it was carefully calculated and written down in a little book, a bucol, for every single settler. And they had to pay it all back to the Dominium. Over six annual installments, starting January 1st, 1791.
So it was a loan.
A loan, absolutely. And a pretty strict one. Crucially, they weren't allowed to sell any of those animals they were initially given without telling the Dominium first and getting permission.
So control. It keeps coming back to control.
Deep control. It was about setting them up, yes, but also ensuring they were productive for the Dominium and stayed tied to them financially.
Okay, so despite the debt and the labor, this contract does seem to cover everything. What were the actual clear-cut benefits that would make someone sign up for this?
Well, there were some definite pluses. Free building wood from the Dominium's forests. If you needed repairs, you just had to ask.
Okay, that's useful.
And free firewood. One cartload a week from May to October, then two cartloads a week in the winter months, November to April.
Sounds good, but I bet there's a catch with the firewood, too.
You're learning. Yes, they had to go get it themselves on assigned days.
Right.
And they could only take specific types. Rotten wood, fallen branches, windbreaks, stumps, no cutting down good trees.
Right. Resource management, anything else.
Yeah, for their animals. The Dominium promised to breed the settlers' mares and cows using its own stallions and bulls on and gild, like, free of charge.
Okay, that is a tangible benefit for farmers, like access to better breeding stock at no cost.
Definitely. And maybe the biggest draw initially.
What's that?
Three volier. Three full years, completely free from all feudal dues and obligations. No rent, no required labor for the lord, nothing. From the start of 1785 to the end of 1788.
3 years tax-free, essentially. That's significant.
Very significant. Plus a protection clause. The Dominium was nemals berectic, never allowed to force a settler's child or servant into their service. Some protection for the family unit.
Okay, so there were real incentives. Yeah. But you know what's coming. A contract this detailed, this controlling, it must have come with a hefty list of obligations and restrictions, right?
Yeah.
What were the downsides?
Absolutely. The control was pervasive. For starters, the farmhouse and land once set up could niemals getrennt oder getrennt werden können, never be divided or separated under any circumstances.
So no splitting the farm among heirs?
Nope. Heirs could farm it together or one could take it over, but then they'd have to buy out the others. The farm unit had to stay intact. Always.
Designed to keep the plots productive, I guess. What about financially, after they started paying back the loan and the grace period ended?
Well, for the first 15 years, they were forbidden from taking on any other debts secured by their house, land, animals, or tools. And creditors couldn't seize those assets either.
Hmm. Protection or control? Maybe both.
Probably both. Protects the Dominium's initial investment, prevents settlers from getting into trouble early on. But after those 15 years, if they wanted to sell...
Could they?
Yes, but only im Ganzen as a whole unit. And this is key only to another noch unangesiedelter Deutscher. Another German who wasn't already settled there.
Wow. So they were actively managing the ethnic and economic makeup of the community for the long term.
Precisely. And legal control. The Dominium kept das Recht der ersten Instanz. Basically, first level legal jurisdiction over the settlers.
So the Lord was also the judge, at least initially.
Effectively, yes. And they held Dominium directum over ownership. They had the explicit right to evict settlers.
For what reasons?
If they, ihr Wirtschaft vernachlässiget, neglected their farm and let it fall into ruin, or if they didn't pay their ground rent for a year due to Offenbacher Liederlichkeit, which translates roughly to obvious licentiousness or dissolute living, but they needed the okay from the Royal District Office for that.
Still, the threat of eviction was real. Any other property rules?
Yeah, no settler could ever own two farms. If you inherited a second one, you had to sell it within Jahr und Tag, a year and a day.
One family, one farm. Got it. What about ongoing rent and labor after the three free years?
Okay, so starting January 1st, 1787, they owed annual ground rent, 40 X's whatever currency unit that was per carats for the house, garden, and planted fields, though they got an exemption for 6 carats left fallow.
So rent based on productive land use.
Right. And the labor came back too. After the free years, it was 8 Busrobok stage, essentially labor days per year, working on dominium buildings or helping with the harvest.
Was that paid?
Yes, paid at 10x's cash per day, maximum 2 days a week. Plus, they had to help maintain local roads, bridges, dams, unpaid, presumably.
And if you couldn't pay the rent in cash?
You could work it off at set rates. The system covered all angles.
It really did. But there's that one clause you mentioned earlier, the one that feels almost Orwellian, maybe?
Ah, you mean the neighbor watching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about that again. It's just stunning.
It really is. The contract states, Jeder Ansiedler soll gehalten sein, auf seinen Nachbar ein obachtsames Auge zu haben. Every settler was obligated to keep a watchful eye on their neighbor.
Obligated to watch.
And to report them. Dem Dominio anzuzeigen. Report to the Dominium anyone, der seine Wirtschaft vernachlässiget oder nicht so, wie es sein sollte, bebaut, besorvet. Anyone who neglects their farm or doesn't cultivate it properly.
So you had a legal duty to spy on your neighbor's farming skills and report them if they weren't up to scratch. That's intense social engineering.
It's an incredible level of mandated community oversight built right into the founding document. Beyond that, other rules too. No fishing in the Lord's ponds, no hunting in their forests, ever. All Seiten.
Right. And regular taxes, military duties.
All of that kicked in after the free years too. Royal taxes, housing soldiers, providing transport if needed. And none of that reduced what they owed the Dominium.
And how did they keep track of all these payments and labor days?
Remember the Buchel for the initial loan? They also got a Gabenbuchel, a dues book, everything. Rent paid, labor days worked, was recorded there. For transparency, presumably.
Makes sense. And they had a judge from among the settlers.
Yes, they elected a judge who then had to be confirmed by the Dominium. This judge's job included upholding the rules, including the farming standards. But interestingly,
what?
The judge got no special reward. No reduction in his own rent or labor duties for doing the job. It was just an added responsibility.
Wow. Okay, so this contract clearly dominated the settlers' lives. But it also sounds like a huge project for the Dominium. What was really in it for them, especially financially, to go to all this trouble?
Ah, well, the contract is surprisingly open about that, too. It wasn't just about long-term rents. There was an immediate financial incentive.
Oh, from whom?
From the district office in the state, essentially. They promised the Dominium 250 guilders.
Per settler?
No, per family. Für jede der übernehmenden 100 Familien, for each of the 100 families they took on.
Okay, 250 guilders times 100 families.
That's 25,000 guilders, a very tidy sum back then, paid in advance.
Paid in advance. What was the catch for the Dominium then?
The condition. Count Zamoyski, the ordinate, the head of the Dominium, had to guarantee the gänzliche Etablierung, the complete establishment of all 100 colonist families by the end of September 1786.
So they got the cash up front. But they were on a tight deadline, less than 2 years to get everyone settled and the farms up and running.
Exactly. It highlights that this was a major investment, yes, but also a calculated business move with significant state backing and a performance target. High risk, potentially high reward for the Dominium.
That really puts a different spin on it. It wasn't just feudal obligation. It was a state-sponsored development project with cash incentives.
Absolutely. And one last detail showing their foresight. The contract allowed for other, later freiwillige Vergleichspunkte, voluntary agreements between the Dominium and settlers.
Okay.
But it explicitly stated these new agreements would not automatically apply to the settlers' heirs.
Ah, so they could make individual deals, but the core eternal contract remained the baseline for future generations unless specifically renegotiated for them too.
Precisely. Thinking ahead, always.
So wrapping this up. We've seen this 1785 Zamgas contract was just incredibly comprehensive. I mean, from land allocation and house specs to livestock loans, labor duties, rent schedules, even spy on your neighbors.
Mm.
All designed to create this specific community, supposedly forever.
Yeah, and if you step back, it's more than just an old document, isn't it? It's like a snapshot, a blueprint of how society tried to manage huge things. Migration, economic development, social order, all written down in painstaking detail.
And it really shows how individual lives were just completely tangled up with these bigger state goals and the Lord's plans.
Profoundly intertwined. It's a fascinating look at planned settlement from that era.
So here's a thought to leave you with. Imagine signing up for that today, a contract that maps out your life, your descendants' lives, and even makes you responsible for watching your neighbor's work ethic.
Right.
What does that extreme level of control tell us about how people back then saw community or even freedom, and maybe? How do echoes of that kind of planned living or social oversight resonate or maybe even clash with our ideas today?